10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, March the 16th in the glorious future year of 2024, and I am coming to you by pre-recording, because it is my grandmother's 100th birthday today, and I'm too busy with the stuff that goes along with that to do a live show for you. Sorry, folks. I have my priorities. Now, as I've said in the past, recent generations have seen a colossal change in the conditions of human life. You know, Cicero, in his De Senectute, speaks of the king of Tartessus, who lived to be 120 years old. And, so far as we can tell, a little beyond 120 is, by some biological mechanism, about the limit of human life. But average lifespans in recent generations have increased greatly as a result of a shift in the age distribution of mortality. In other words, as I've often quoted, before the industrial era, roughly one-third of children born alive did not live to see their fifth birthdays. If you look at the mortality distribution, any time in the past, any place in the past, basically, the Roman Empire, the European Middle Ages, classical China, any place that we have anything resembling data for, you find that, typically, the chance that an infant born alive would survive to the age of 50 is much less than 20%. Whereas, for someone born in the United States, for example, 50 to 60 years ago, the chance that they have survived to age 50 is better than 80%. This is a complete inversion of the pattern of human life as it was established for countless ages in the past. Now, how is that possible? Well, a great deal of it, of course, has to do with things like modern medicine. My grandma was born before the polio vaccine. My parents were born before the polio vaccine. My mother very clearly recalls the last year that the swimming pools in Dallas were closed due to an outbreak of polio. My parents were born before the measles vaccine. My mother had measles. Grandma was born before penicillin. The revolution of modern medicine had only just begun to get started when she was born back in 1924. But the measles vaccine and the polio vaccine have been so incredibly effective that now, even though those diseases and the terrible consequences of them are still well within living memory, people just don't believe in them anymore. And we're seeing people refuse to vaccinate their children against measles and polio. Why should they? Nothing bad ever happened to anybody because of measles or polio. They're not real. When Grandma was born, you know, some progress had been made towards sanitary water supplies and sewage arrangements in major cities, but universal chlorination of urban water supplies was certainly not an accomplished fact in those days. And as for universal treatment of sanitary sewer waste, it's still not there, even in wealthy countries like Canada. But it is, as I've said before, these increased survival rates which have primarily led to the increasing global human population. It's not that people are having more kids. In fact, the number of births per woman has declined sharply in most parts of the world. But more children are living to reach reproductive age, which means more children born overall, and people are living longer so that they are counted in more decennial censuses. That seems pretty obvious, right? If you have the same number of people born every year in two countries, one country where people on average live to be 40, and one country where people on average live to be 80, The population of the second country will be twice the population of the first country. It's a mathematical necessity. But what are the factors that underlie these longer lifespans? What are the factors that underlie the factors that I've cited? Well, one of them is, believe it or not, the increased population itself. By virtue of there being more people, it's possible to have a greater subdivision of labor and a greater degree of specialization. There are more specialists in each field and more subfields of scientific and technological inquiry and development now than ever in the past, in part simply because there are more people. We can have more PhD biophysicists than ever before. In 1960, the number was zero. Of course, large populations by themselves do not lead to constructive specialization and the kind of division of labor which results in greater productivity. What else do you have to have that was missing in classical China or medieval India, which certainly had large populations? You need a vibrant intellectual life, a respect for learning and a transmission of information and culture, which certainly the Chinese had the respect for learning. On the other hand, they didn't have the printing press. They didn't have easy ways to circulate information. Texts mostly had to be hand-copied by scribes, which is laborious whether you're doing it in Latin or in Chinese. Another factor that's very important is social mobility. If every man is constrained to the same station in life that his father occupied, then inevitably people will not be found in the social roles that they are most suited to. People who are good at A, but are required by the caste system to do B, are going to do a mediocre job at B. And so your overall productivity, whether in terms of economic output, in terms of knowledge gained, what have you, and the advancement of your society, is going to be much less than if people who are good at A are allowed to do A and people who are good at B are allowed to do B. This is part of the reason for the very slow economic development and social development of the American South before the Second World War as compared with the North and the West. But, as I have pointed out, that was not an unintended consequence. It was by design. The people who held power in the South knew that economic and social development were threats to their power, and they cared far more about keeping that power than about prosperity or well-being of the people in general. Indeed, they would rather have less wealth if it meant they had all of it. But the third factor, as I have so often said, the third factor is energy. In other words, the factor which lifts drudgery off of the back of human beings, thus liberating them to do higher and better things with their lives than simply bear burdens. Liberating them to study, to inquire, to pursue their intellectual bents, and develop their capabilities. All of these factors work together in synergism. And this is the reason, I suppose, for my great skepticism, as I expressed last week, towards the idea of degrowth, which seeks to attack at least some of those factors. You know, as I said, it surprises me that degrowth advocates get upset when you say they favor genocide, even though they keep saying there are too many humans on Earth, the number of humans must be reduced. How are you going to do that that doesn't amount to genocide? You don't necessarily have to murder 6 billion people to commit genocide if you say, well, we're going to restrict everybody on Earth to one child, and that way the population will decrease. Well, firstly, even if that's administered with absolute evenness, it's going to mean that small minorities may disappear simply because they wind up having too few people to keep their culture and language and so forth alive. But what we've seen in China, certainly, is that such things are not administered in any even-handed way, that the majority will be policed less than minorities, that the wealthy will be policed less than the poor. You absolutely will have disparities and those disparities will not be favorable to the groups which are already suffering from a disadvantage, to the groups which are already marginalized. You don't have to be a genius to figure this out. You don't have to be a great intellectual to figure this out. You just have to be a little bit curious and a little bit alive to the world around you. Which is why it galls me to mention this and then be told I have the mindset of a teenage troll. I think that if you've been listening to these shows for any length of time, you know that I put a great value on serious contemplation of the questions I discuss. But when somebody says in one breath that billions of humans should be eliminated, and in the next breath that it's insulting and libelous to say that they favor genocide, I'm at a loss for what to think. But because of those interlocking or intertwining, mutually supporting and synergistic factors that I mentioned earlier, when somebody says, oh, well, we could do without billions of people, I'm inclined to question it. You see people say, well, the population is larger than it's ever been. We got along fine without all these people in the past. Did we? Did we really? Because, again, we've made great advances through having a larger population and a greater division of labor. Now, the greater division of labor doesn't, as I said, rest entirely on that larger population. But I do not know how we're supposed to keep it if we start pruning back the population. Because, of course, somebody will say, well, you just start with the people who are, you know, less important. Yeah. Whose definition are we supposed to go by? The people who are less intellectually developed, what have you. If you go by the Wall Street Journal opinions, right, they're always talking about unskilled labor as though the people who do it were easily replaceable and so on, and of no particular importance. And I'm just sitting here thinking about garbage strikes. You know, the people who are to be found talking about how important they are to the world economy in the Wall Street Journal don't think that the work of trash collectors is of any importance. If it doesn't get done, you're in a world of trouble. But they assume that the people who do the work are unimportant and easily replaced, and I don't buy it. I think that what we need to be doing is going the other direction, in a sense. Is finding the people in the intellectually and culturally undeveloped, not just parts of the world, but parts of advanced societies, and giving them a leg up so that they can also specialize and divide labor more efficiently and effectively, so that we can make further progress in the development of our knowledge, of our collective culture, of our technology. And again, this is what bothers me when people say, oh, well, we should just use less energy. William P. Tavarulias, who was an advisor to President Carter, said in a commentary on the Ford Foundation's Energy Policy Report, A Time to Choose America's Energy Future, the basic thesis of this project becomes, the search for energy and the use of energy is bad, while energy conservation is good. On this base, all else rests. I simply cannot, I do not accept this. I believe this is entirely wrong-headed. But here's the difference between degrowth and disintensification, disintensivization, deintensivization. I need a better word for this. But here's the difference as it was expressed by a proponent of degrowth. Degrowth doesn't mean doing more with less, it means doing less with less. It is my opinion, and I can't go any farther than saying it is my opinion, that as you reduce the population, you will find that your ability to support that population at the same standard of living declines faster than the population itself, meaning that standards of living fall. It is my opinion that as your standard of living falls, your efficiency in the use of resources falls faster. In other words, you start trying to do less with less, and you find that the do less shrinks much more rapidly than the with less. Now, saying do more with less, that's challenging. We have found great ways to do more with less more. In other words, that the standard of living can increase more rapidly than the consumption of resources. To increase the standard of living without increasing consumption of resources. To increase the standard of living while reducing consumption of resources. That's a very difficult problem. But I believe it can be addressed as long as we're willing to increase our consumption of energy, which, as I have said before, is the universal substitute. It allows us to avoid consuming other scarce resources. It allows us to recycle plastic more perfectly, as I've described. It allows us to get fresh water from the sea and a lot of other mineral resources that can be obtained from seawater. Inland, it could also potentially allow us to get fresh water and mineral resources from saline aquifers, because there is a far greater quantity of water underground in saline aquifers than in freshwater aquifers. As a matter of fact, I would go so far as to say that energy, and particularly nuclear energy, fission energy, let's be very explicit about this. Fission energy provides a suite of solutions to what are otherwise intractable problems of our current world. Now, I don't say that they're easy solutions to implement. They require engineering and technical effort and all those kinds of things. But they are straightforward, and they seem to me to be considerably less difficult than pretty much any other approach to the same problem. And I think this is, to some extent, where the opposition to nuclear energy comes from. It just seems too easy. People become convinced, as you might say, that if something is too easy, there must be a catch. People believe that nuclear energy somehow represents a deal with the devil. They imagine the sorcerer's apprentice letting his tools run away from him. I'm certain that's wrong, but I do think it's where some of the opposition comes from. But what are we offered in its stead? Things that, to me at least, appear crashingly unrealistic. As a great example, in the Wall Street Journal this week, there was a big article about a proposal to build by far the world's largest conventional airplane. In other words, with a roughly cylindrical hull and wings and that sort of thing. 110 meters long, equipped with large low-pressure tires to enable it to take off and land from grass fields, or at least packed dirt. What in the world is this supposed to be for? Well, the answer is so that it can carry, one at a time, 100-meter wind turbine blades, which are, as you can imagine, difficult to transport to many of the places where people might want to install wind machines. Now, 100-meter blades, implying towers 120 or 150 meters tall, just so that the blades are well clear of the ground. What is the rationale for this? Well, the first is that it means larger generators. As I've said, it is cheaper to wind one 10-megawatt generator than 10 1-megawatt generators. Secondly, the variability of the wind decreases as you get higher off the ground, so your generator already costs less per nameplate watt, and it should also deliver more per nameplate watt. As against this, however, there are some fairly obvious problems. And I'm not even going to try to enumerate them all, but you can see if you come up with some for yourself. As an example, the blade disc, with 100-meter long blades, is going to be quite heavy, so when the wind is not blowing, the tower will tend to tilt forwards. On the other hand, when the wind is blowing, because of the resistance of the blade disc to the wind, the tower will tend to tilt backwards. It becomes a structural problem. The towers begin to become very heavy and expensive. They also begin to suffer quite badly from low cycle fatigue due to the tilting motion as the wind increases or decreases, but also from high cycle fatigue owing to the effect of the blade passing in front of the tower, which suddenly unloads it. Again, there's going to be a substantial variability of wind profile over the blade disc, implying that each blade will have to be individually controlled so that its pitch increases as the average wind speed over it decreases, decreases as the average wind speed over it increases, so that the pull it exerts on the hub remains roughly constant all the time. Now, it's not terribly difficult to build the servo mechanisms required to do that, but I do wonder how durable they're likely to be. So between the erosion of the blades by the simple action of the wind, and the flexion of the towers that they're mounted on, and all these other matters, It strikes me that it will be difficult to make such large wind machines last any longer than the current ones. So you're looking at a lifespan of 12 to 20 years. Making them last longer than that, I will never say it's impossible, but in terms of engineering practice, I suspect it would be very unattractively costly. Whereas, once again, as I've mentioned, it's not that difficult to build a nuclear power plant that lasts 60 years. So you have a 3 to 5-fold advantage in lifespan before you have to go replacing the equipment. What that means is, if you want to replace your existing fossil fuel generation with something else, if you want to increase your total energy use so that you can de-extensify, then it becomes 3 to 5 times easier in that respect to use nuclear rather than renewables. And you can also look at, as I said, the amount of raw materials consumed per kilowatt of nameplate capacity, and all that manner of thing. And it becomes more and more difficult to believe for a moment the claims of the renewables enthusiasts who, if you bring up nuclear energy, will always say, oh, there's no place for it in today's world, because renewables are now the cheapest source of energy, and by 2050, it's all the world will be using simply because it's so cheap that it'll edge out everything else. I don't believe it. I don't believe it because it doesn't make any technical sense. And one of the manifestations of that lack of technical sense is this business about building the world's largest airplane to carry individual wind machine blades. Now, nuclear power plants have some very large individual components, reactor pressure vessels and steam generators, that kind of thing, which are notoriously difficult to transport. But you don't have to do it very often, and you don't have to do very many of those jobs. The blades for a 10-megawatt wind turbine, well, you need 3 blades per turbine, and you'll probably need about 300 of them to make up 1,000 megawatts of real output. So that's, 900 blades. For the equivalent of, let's say, in a typical PWR power plant, 1 reactor pressure vessel and 3 steam generators. And you want to upgrade to a 4-loop PWR, well, the reactor pressure vessel is about the same size, actually. So it becomes 1 RPV and 4 steam generators. And you'll need to replace the steam generators after 30 years, typically. So in a 60-year lifespan, you have to transport 1 RPV and 8 steam generators. Okay. And that's for a 1,200 to 1,400-megawatt nuclear power plant. So that's as opposed to 1,200 or so wind turbine blades, which have to be replaced at 20-year intervals, to be generous to them. So 3 times 1,200 in the course of 60 years, right? So 3,600 flights of the giant transport airplane, as opposed to 9 deliveries of big manufactured items for the nuclear plant. But again, even if we were to accept as factual the claim that renewables are now the cheapest source of energy, the other claims that they're making wouldn't necessarily follow. In a fairly conventional central station electric system, transmission and distribution often accounts for 40 to 60% of the cost of a kilowatt hour delivered to the consumer. What that means is, if the generation were absolutely free, if there were no cost associated with it whatsoever, but you had to increase the transmission and distribution infrastructure costs 2 to 3 times, the cost to the consumer would not go down at all. And it's no secret that transmission and distribution costs are much higher for systems with substantial proportions of wind and solar in them. And that comes about for a number of reasons. One of the most obvious is that the generation is often located relatively far from the load center. As I always emphasize, you can build your nuclear power plant close in the environs of a major city. It's not simple to do that with wind or solar in most instances. So, for example, Germany has the continuing problem that they've built lots of wind installations on the Baltic, but they can't get that power to southern Germany without lots of new power lines which they haven't actually built. There's been some discussion, in fact, of separating Germany into 2 power markets, one for the north and one for the south, but this is not regarded highly by the Bundesministerium because it would expose the hollowness of their energy and economic policy. Another obvious fact is that wind and solar are distributed over large areas, meaning that you have to connect all those scattered generators together. In other words, the generation requires a network which looks very like the distribution network in, say, a suburb. And that doesn't come without some kind of a cost. And then, of course, there is the higher peak-to-average factor to be considered. In other words, because sun and wind generation come when they come, not when you call for them, the power lines that you build to connect sun and wind generation projects with the load centers are going to be unloaded or partly loaded much more of the time than the lines that you build to connect conventional generators to the load centers. Because the lines to connect renewables projects to the load centers are only going to be loaded during the overlap of the load curve with the generation curve of the generator. Whereas, if you have a generator which is capable of constant output, then the overlap of that and the load curve is just the load curve. These are all quite elementary considerations. They don't go into the cost of batteries. They don't go into the cost of smart grid equipment. They don't go into the cost of changing the design of everything from appliances to industrial facilities to cope with periods of inadequate or not present power. Because, of course, demand management is the name of the game. In other words, turning things off when there's not adequate power. That means that the things that you're turning off have to be capable of standing up to that turning off, which means design alterations. Generally speaking, it means more mass. It could mean, in the case of your refrigerator, making it twice as large so that it has a space for a big block of ice in the bottom. In the case of things like aluminum smelters and other kinds of industrial facilities, it could mean very radical changes. None of those changes are going to be without cost. Then you have to factor in, of course, the virtual cost of lost productivity during periods of inadequate or missing energy supply. If you're doing demand management, and that means that your major industrial process, instead of running 100% of the time, has to be shut down 20% of the time, that means that you have to provision more of it in order to get the same output. And so you have to pay the capital cost of more facilities, which, as I've just mentioned, are liable to be more expensive facilities, which are sitting idle a chunk of the time. So these are all factors that drive costs, not just of energy, but in general, for everything, cost of living, as it were, up and up and up and up and up, as you try to integrate more of these will-they-won't-they energy sources into the system. Does that sound like conservation to you? Because it doesn't sound like conservation to me. It doesn't sound like disextensification to me. It sounds like the situation which requires more resources to maintain the same standard of living. And, of course, if your response is, well, just back off on the standard of living then, I think that you are very callous. I think that you don't value human life and human welfare very much at all. And that is why I am so skeptical of the arguments of the renewable energy proponents and promoters. I don't see that it hangs together into a picture of a world that's good for people to live in and that is particularly sustainable. Sustainability is a difficult problem. I don't think we should be making it worse. All of that to one side, I thought you might like to know that I have found a local graphics business which is willing to scan my larger format nuclear energy public information materials for a considerably lower price than I had previously been quoted. So I should have some new scans of posters and such like available very soon for incorporation into my various projects and probably for putting up on the web in one form or another. Good news, right? Also, I have made an appointment for next Thursday to go to a place in Dallas that does risograph printing and hopefully do the outer jackets for 100 or 150 copies of issue number one of Blast. So at this point, basically the only thing I'm waiting on is...